Okay, let's go on to the next agenda item. The time is 3:21 p.m. The next item is agenda item number 17, which is 2007-2008 number 114, Rail Authority and Sales Tax for its operation. We do have, just note for the record, the Office of State Planning and Budgeting provided a fiscal impact of this measure, and a copy of that is on the table. Mr. Reichert, is that
Richard,
correct?
Yes.
Richard, is that right?
Okay. For the record, I'm Mark Richard, representing myself and my co-petitioner, Graham Hill, who's out of the state at the moment.
Thank you.
First step is typically that we ask questions to make sure we understand the measure. And as I was looking at it, there were a number of things that I was puzzled about. And I do have some questions about it, but let me just sort of back up, because
okay.
I have that led me to some other questions that I want to bring up first. Because I was having some trouble understanding some things about the measure, I went back and pulled the review and comment memo, and then became curious about how the measure might have changed after the review and comment hearing. And so I looked at the three drafts that were submitted to the Secretary of State's office. And so I saw the original version that was submitted for review and comment, saw the final version, and then saw that what the marked up version was a copy of the review and comment memo with written in the upper right hand corner are the words legislative comments, arrow, complete redo, require, I think it says.
Yeah. Required, yes.
And by the way, just for the record, then I had Ms. Gomez contact
yes.
you because I had expected to find a version of that showed the highlighted changes or somehow to show how the original version had changed to become the final version, and was surprised to see them just a memo instead. I'm aware of your email back to Ms. Gomez that says basically it was a complete redo.
Yes.
And so that's why you submitted the review and comment memo.
That's correct.
Which leads me to two questions. Really two related questions. I mean, the statute does require that proponents submit a marked-up version that shows the changes, and second, that the changes be in response to the review and comment.
Yes.
And I guess I'm concerned about both of those because I could not immediately identify how some of the changes were in response to the review and comment. And then likewise, it wasn't obvious to me why you could not mark up the original version, like highlight where the changes were and that kind of thing. It looked like they were very similar measures. In response to review and comment, I saw that you did add headings and numbering and a number of things like that. But it seemed like I also saw that there were new sections added. New provisions that were added?
There were provisions added. As I stated in email, what's hard is that there was extensive discussion at the hearing of about an hour in length about clarity, about what was missing, failure to provide clarity about the intent. And that's where I stated where I didn't have a transcript of that meeting. Therefore, I did the changes based upon my notes and what was most pertinent about what they were stating. And that was one of their comments, that I need to be completely reorganized. And there were a number of, like I stated, that they stated there was an extensive lack of clarity, that I need to be reorganized. And there was also just lack of clarity on fundamentals dealing with transit policy, which relate directly to this. And those notes from that one-hour discussion is really what was most pertinent in the changes. I didn't keep the notes because I didn't realize that I needed an actual transcript or non-personal notes of that meeting, because that meeting is what really influenced the final form.
And actually, just for the record, what I'd like to distribute to the board and to Mr. Kneiser is a copy of your email to Ms. Gomez as well, just because there is some explanation in there where I think you were explaining what you were just saying, that you didn't have a transcript, of course, and we don't normally expect you to do that, but that your changes were based on those notes and so forth.
That's correct, because there were the textual changes based on a comment to them prior to the meeting, which were done, but the meeting itself was what was most pertinent to as far as reorganization and creating clarity. Other than that, there were no other, I mean, as far as intent and as far as the intent of the ballot initiative, that didn't change from the original to the document submitted. It was rather changes based upon that back and forth with them, from which I took personal notes but didn't keep formal notes.
Well, let me ask just about, I mean, looking at some of the changes. I mean, what, for example, it looks like you've added several paragraphs. I don't know. Let me figure. Like Section 6, Interstate Connections, that provides that the Colorado Rail Authority shall have the authority to cooperate and enter into agreements with adjacent states to create passenger rail and freight service connecting Colorado to adjacent states. How is that in response to the comments at the review and comment?
They specifically asked if the authority would be permitted to make connections with other states, that it was ambiguous, and that the intent wasn't clear on that. And therefore, I put that section in there because that was the intent, and that was a specific question they asked.
And I didn't see that in the memo. Is it in the memo, or is it just something you're saying they asked in addition to the memo?
Well, in addition to the memo, because like I stated, it was a one-hour meeting, during which time I took personal notes to make specific changes based on generally what they said. And I, as far as the email only deals with the general gist of what they told me as far as the five major issues, which aren't specific issues because I did not know I had to address their specific, that I had to transcribe their comments and specifically address those comments.
Well, and again, I'm not saying that you had need to transcribe anything, although normally the questions and comments are in the memo.
Okay.
Usually this doesn't come up, but it sounds like you've made changes that were not in the memo, but that were nevertheless comments made by the legislative staff.
That's correct, yes.
So there's several things in here that appear to be added about who owns the rights of way and the stock and so forth and the leasing back and so forth, and I didn't see that in the review and comment.
There was a specific conversation during the review and comment meeting about the compliance with Tabor and lack of clarity about whether or not it met compliance because of the way it was written. Therefore, I addressed their specific comments about how it would be compliant with Tabor, which was the intent, but not specifically written out.
Is the comment about Tabor in the memo?
No, it's not. Like I said, it was a one-hour conversation, and I had a 3 o'clock deadline, so I just took personal notes for the most specific, for the most pertinent comments and incorporated them, while being careful not to change any intent or so forth.
Would it be fair to say that what is now Section 6, Section 8, and Section 9 were all added after the review and comment hearing based on
comments, yes.
Oral comments that are not in the memo.
That's correct, yes.
That were not raised in the staff memo. Okay.
The staff memo that came prior to the review and comment hearing was entirely textual changes based upon language, not upon intent or clarifications or anything of that nature.
But there is a section, as I recall, the staff memo, I mean, on page 2, there's a series of questions under the heading Technical Comments and Questions. And then eventually, I think it moves on to substantive questions. On page 5, substantive comments and questions. And I did notice that there were changes in response to some of these, as I recall.
Yes.
But I don't. But again, it surprised me that I didn't see anything in here about Tabor. Well, I see 7B refers to Tabor, although I'm not sure that that's relating to the changes
well,
that I was raising.
The original intent naturally was to be in compliance with Tabor, and during the review and comment hearing, it was stated again about how there wasn't clarity about that compliance, which is what I stated on there, that there was lack of clarity on the compliance with Tabor. So that's why those changes were made.
And so, for example, is the what you added about who owns and who rents the facilities,
yes.
How does that relate to compliance with Tabor?
It relies to compliance with Tabor as far as being an authority. Tabor deals specifically with something being its operations being funded by the state of Colorado, and this is something which operationally would not be funded by the state of Colorado. The state of Colorado, the tax funds the infrastructure, the physical property, the means of being able to operate. Whereas, but there's nothing, there's, and it specifically states there's nothing in there for operations.
Okay. Well, I this is really hard because it's just we are required to make sure that the changes are in response to review and comment, and I'm having really these two difficulties: is that I can't really confirm by looking at the memo that some of these changes are in response to the comments, and it's the job is more difficult because the second version doesn't really mark it up, so it's a little hard to see even what you have changed.
I understand that.
Unless I do a proof one against the other, I can't see what the differences are.
Oh, I understand that.
And that's
stated,
what, and I think that's what the purpose of the statutory requirement is, that you provide a marked up version so that the board can tell what was changed.
Okay. I understand that.
And merely attaching a copy of the memo is just not very helpful.
Well, I understand that. As I stated, I contacted someone at the Secretary of State's office that morning while getting ready to make changes based upon the comments from the review and comment hearing, and also went in personally and wasn't told exactly what I need to be in full compliance, which I stated that I wish to do.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and it is hard for, I think, the staff of the Secretary of State's office to know, given that they don't know what your changes are, it's hard to know how you should comply with that. I mean, people do it in different ways.
Yes.
Some people use strike type in all caps or underscoring, or they actually use a yellow highlighter to show where the changes are, and it kind of depends on what your changes are.
I understand that. If they provided me with something like that, I would have taken a copy of that and gone right out and created that. That's why I was there at that time. I wasn't there at 3 o'clock. I was there at 1:30, something like that, to have margin for error.
Well, and
I think part of the problem here is that staff of the Secretary of State can't be given legal advice.
That's part of the problem.
This is essentially legal advice.
Well, I'm not sure if it's providing legal advice, but if you show somebody these are three different ways that were accepted, things that aren't even related to what you've done, then okay, fine, I can take one of those and do it in that manner. But without that, I didn't know how.
Well, I don't want to be unduly defensive about this, but the Secretary of State's office does do that. We post for every measure on the website. The Secretary of State posts the three versions that are filed for each measure, so you can go out and see how other proponents have complied with that requirement.
I understand that. I didn't have access to that because I had just had I forget how many hours to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, like I say, part of the difficulty is I'm not sure what you've changed from the original submittal, and I'm not sure how much of it is in response to the review and comment memo. But that's one difficulty. Those are two difficulties. I mean, in both of them, I think, are potentially jurisdictional because they're both statutory requirements that proponents do provide. It's the statute... requires that proponents, after the review and comment hearing, file with the Secretary of State a copy of the original typewritten draft, copy of the amended draft with changes highlighted or otherwise indicated, if any amendments were made, and then an original final copy which shows the final language. So I'm concerned about compliance with that, and then the other one that I'm concerned about is the statutory requirement that says, and I want to go over this a little bit because it may lead to what the board should do, if anything, you know, if there is a problem with this. It does say that that after the review and comment meeting, the proponents may amend in response to some or all of the comments. If any substantial amendment is made to the petition, other than an amendment in direct response to the comments of the staff, the amended petition shall be resubmitted to the directors for comment. So that, in other words, if there were changes that went beyond the comments, they should have been resubmitted to the legislative staff. So it, like I say, it goes to whether or not the measure, both of these go to the question of whether the measure is properly before the board. So I don't know. I don't know whether I want to focus on that too much, because I think it, like I said, it also relates to just questions I have about the measure as well. And it's important for us to understand the measure in order to determine whether it complies with a single subject requirement. And so maybe while I put aside for the time being my concern about those other two requirements, maybe we ought to just go ahead and see what other questions we have about the measure, because they might be part and parcel of the same basic question of whether or not we can set a title. Maybe I'll ask if the board members have questions about the measure. Ms. Eubanks?
I'm confused with your measure, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to clarify. It seems like it's taking two different approaches sort of all at the same time, and I'm not sure how to try to work it out. I mean, in the purpose statement, you talk about the authority having sort of building, design, and operating. And then you have certain provisions down, like in Section 1, that they have power of eminent domain, which seems relevant to being able to build a rail line. You have sort of the authority to enter into build, design, and operate contracts if the board members vote to do that. And so those provisions seem to have the authority doing it all. And then when you get to Section 8, you talk about, and also in Section 5, you have a reference that the authority builds all the new facilities and restores old facilities to the LEED standards. But then when you get to Section 8, it talks about the state is the legal entity that owns the right-of-way, the tracks, the stations, rolling stock, all the maintenance facilities, and that the authority is the enterprise which then leases these facilities from the state. And then in Section 9, you talk about the state renting to the authority. And so it seems internally inconsistent that in one place you're talking about the state doing sort of the bricks and mortar part of it, and then in other parts of the measure you talk about the authority doing it. And so in my mind, it's not clear to me who's doing what, in terms of sort of the bricks and mortar portion of the measure.
Well, the bricks and mortar portion of the measure, the issue is, which came up at the review and comment hearing, was the compliance with Tabor and the concept behind this. And the concept behind this is that there's an entity that operates, that is responsible for the daily and annual operation of a rail authority within Colorado, while being in compliance with Tabor. So the real property of such an agency, such as the University of Colorado, Division of Wildlife, their real property is owned by the state of Colorado, even though they operate as enterprises. The secondary reason for that is outside of the provisions of the measure, which is simply that when you're dealing with insurance rates for any kind of transportation, if something is owned legally by a state or governmental agency, it has much reduced insurance rates versus that of it being a private entity.
And I understand the whole approach in terms of enterprise status and not getting more than 10% of its revenues from the state or local governments. But part of my problem in understanding the measure is that some of the provisions seem to be inconsistent with that concept that's set forth in Section 8 in terms of other provisions of the measure say that it's the authority that builds, designs. I mean, for example, giving the authority the ability to enter into a build, design, and operate contract doesn't seem to make much sense when the authority isn't really building the facility, and that's the confusion I have about, I mean, and it goes to, if I'm trying to set a title describing this measure, I'm not sure how to describe it.
What happens with a build, design, operate contract, which puts everything in one place, which is the design of it, the construction, and the operation, is that that's going to be done by, if that's privatized, that's done by one entity. So the real property is still owned by the state of Colorado, and also the reason the Rail Authority deals with the construction and then would convey things to the state of Colorado goes back to being an enterprise and also as far as where the technical expertise is. I mean, is the state of Colorado going to build something for a rail authority and then try to figure out if it's done correctly, or is the Rail Authority going to build that and convey it to the state of Colorado? And that's the intent of it, and that is why also the sales tax specifically states that it's only for the real property. It's not for the operations.
And I you have to forgive me, but now I'm getting more confused, because if the authority can build, then you get back to you can't build unless you have the sales tax revenues, and you can't get the sales tax revenues directly as an enterprise based on previous court interpretation, and that's, it's sort of, it seems like either the authority's building it or the state's building it, and it seems I don't know which it is, because you've got it both ways in the measure.
Well, it's analogous to what's to privatization of parts of the operations of RTD, such as Boulder is the largest part of RTD, and under state statute, RTD is required to privatize a certain amount of their operations. So all the operations in Boulder are privatized. However, the buses are still owned by RTD. They're leased to First Transit.
It isn't that I don't understand the build, design, operate concept. It's that I don't understand how it's working in this particular context with the authority, because the authority can't get the tax revenue to build.
Yes.
And so I don't understand why the authority has a build, design ability. It's sort of like eminent domain. If you can't build the facilities, it doesn't seem like you should have, the authority would have the power of eminent domain. It would be the state condemning whatever property is necessary. They build the facilities, and then they lease those facilities to you. And that's why I'm confused. It's sort of like the provision in Section 5 about the Rail Authority shall build all new facilities to the LEED standards. Well, if the state's building the facilities, I don't understand how the authority builds all new facilities to the LEED standards when the authority isn't building anything. And that's my confusion about the inconsistency within the measure of trying to sort it out, because I don't know how to explain it in a title as to what the role is of the authority versus the role of the state.
The authority essentially acts as an intermediary for the state with the design of the facilities that are required to have such a rail service in Colorado. So it ends up as real property owned by the state of Colorado. But again, because its specific purpose is for the passenger rail authority, the passenger rail authority needs to state how that real property is going to work, because that real property is going to affect its ability to have to generate the revenue to fund itself.
Let me ask this a different way. state is the only one that can collect the tax revenues. The authority is the one that's building, right? The authority does the building.
Yes.
How does the authority get the money?
The authority...
You're asking, right?
Okay. Well, essentially the authority is working with... acting as the... just for the construction purposes for the state of Colorado to get the facilities constructed, just as First Transit and running buses in Boulder would tell RTD, we're not running enough skip buses, we need another 10 Gillicks, and then RTD would go ahead and procure that. Who's technically buying it? Well, RTD in that instance. Who's actually the one defining the need, and even the RFP in that instance, is the private contractor.
My problem here is that it seems like you have a concept in your mind about how this would work. And it probably works.
Yeah.
I don't see it here.
Okay.
That's what I'm missing. I'm missing how this is going to work. There needs to my mind, there needs to be more detail about these relationships before we can set a title, send it to the voters, because as is, I don't think it works. I think that's what Ms. Eubanks was trying to get to earlier.
I think I'm sufficiently confused that I'm not sure I understand the measure well enough that I can describe it in a title, and that's one of the things that this board has to do. Because of those internal inconsistencies, I don't know how to describe it, because I mean, understanding your explanation, but in terms of based on what's in the measure itself, I don't know how to describe it in a title.
And I believe that was the purpose from the review and comment hearing to write Section 8, which is that the state of Colorado is the legal entity that owns all the real physical property, so that the authority is the enterprise which then operates the facilities. There's been nothing to that extent in the United States. There are things in the northeastern United States where a transit agency actually has a financial company owning its real property and then leasing it back for a tax break. It's a similar situation to that, as well as similar to, like I stated, the RTD privatization of parts of its services while still owning the real property.
Let me ask, this is a question that relates just kind of understanding what the measure is and does. If the measure is a single subject, we're required in the titles to express the single subject. The staff draft says this expresses the subject as the establishment of the Colorado Rail Authority. But I'm really trying to figure out behind that, so what? I mean, I would think a rail authority deals with rails, but the measure broader than that. I mean, Section 4, for example, says that this rail authority can operate rental agencies for bicycles and automobiles and other vehicles. So I'm just trying to figure out how would you describe the purpose of this measure? What are you trying to
achieve? The purpose of this measure, as you stated, is to create a Colorado Rail Authority. Section 4 of dealing with the rental of vehicles was in direct reply to the review and comment, like, why would you have that in there? That does, on the surface, why would you have a rail authority owning cars or bicycles and renting them out? It goes back to the fact that this is responsible for its own daily operations, which means if you can't get people from their front door to the front door of where they're going, they're not going to employ the agency, and they're not going to, therefore, it's not going to be able to meet its operational revenues, just like DIA has car rental. If they didn't have car rental because no business would do so, then they would probably be compelled to do so just to succeed as a transportation venture.
Well, it's still not clicking with me exactly what the per-
purpose is,
and I'm sorry for being dense about it. I mean, it's not rail. It's transportation somehow, I think. Transportation that's energy efficient?
Yes. I mean, the primary purpose is rail. The additional pieces are what you need to make the rail succeed.
To make the rail what?
Succeed.
Succeed.
Make it financially viable. That's why this states that it's not just passenger rail and freight service or one or the other. It's that you need the two to make money, to cover your operational expenses. To be a business that moves people, which is by rail, you have to be able to provide people with getting from their destination at the one point or the other.
Getting back to your comment about DIA, the DIA rental facilities are private companies that go in there and rent. I'm not sure I see the need to have car rental and bicycle facilities. Take the light rail and walk around downtown. They don't have any need to have rental facilities at the various stops.
That's correct. But if you were taking a train from Denver to Pueblo to Alamosa to go to the Great Sand Dunes, how would you get from the station to the sand dunes, you know, 30, 40 miles away once you get there? When you're talking about light rail, such as in Denver, yes, you walk from your house to the light rail, you take the light rail, you walk to your office. But what if those distances are suddenly magnified, as you stated? Well, okay, now it's 40 miles from the station to where people are going. If there's no way to get there because nobody steps up and opens a local rental agency, no one's going to use the rail authority, and it's not going to make money because they're going to get to you know, Alamosa, and there's no way to get there, or even some small town which might have service just once or twice a day.
I'm just still really struggling with, well, related issues of whether the board has jurisdiction, but is it a single subject? I sure don't have much of a focus on how to express the single subject. I mean, saying that it's about establishing a rail authority kind of hides the, it establishes an entity, but if that entity has vague or conflicting purposes, and I'm not saying they are, but I'm just saying that is not good enough necessarily to express a single subject.
I believe under the single subject, I mean, it goes back to that specific comment on Section 8 that the Colorado Rail Authority is the enterprise that operates the facilities. The authority is solely operational for its operational costs. So you have an entity that has to do this. Meet its operational costs. What do you need to have the operational costs? It's similar to someone opening up a restaurant saying, well, okay, they're opening a restaurant, so what's going to be in it? Well, they're going to need tables and chairs and staff to run the restaurant. A lot of those things look different. I mean, a table looks a lot different from a frying pan. A frying pan looks a lot different than the kitchen staff. The kitchen staff looks a lot different from the bar and the TV up front, but it's a restaurant. It's one single thing that can't operate without its pieces. You take away the bar and they're not making money from revenues from the bar, not bringing people in, you take away the food, etc. It's all interrelated. So it's one holistic whole that needs these pieces to get that operational money in.
Well, I'm not sure where we are, so I'm trying to digest this. I guess my gut reaction is that it goes back to review and comment. It seems like there were a lot of changes made after review and comment, and I'm sure they were made in good faith, you know, in an attempt to deal with the discussion that was heard, but I still seemed like this is a very confusing, difficult to understand measure. I'm not sure that the changes that were made effectively do address or even relate to the comments. I just see so much that's been added to this that I don't see in the review and comment hearing. I mean, fundamentally, I think it needs a review and comment hearing. I'm not sure that the language of the measure, and I'm not sure that the language of the measure accomplishes your intent in part, and that's one of the purposes of a review and comment hearing, is to review the language and make sure that it effectively achieves the proponent's intent. And it, you know, just my gut feeling is that this one needs another review and comment hearing. Now that's, you know, so what? Here we're, as a board, faced with the question of whether we have jurisdiction to set a title, and if so, what the title should be. And I'm not sure that I understand the measure well enough to set a title. The court has told us that if we don't understand a measure well enough that we can clearly express a single subject, then we're prohibited from setting titles. And I think that's probably where I am right now. At the same time, I'm trying to balance competing interests here. On the one hand, this is a citizen process, and I think it's important for us not to be unduly technical. And in fact, there's case law to the effect that substantial compliance is the standard of that we can apply here. But I'm just not sure that that there is substantial compliance, at least sufficient for me to understand the measure well enough to set a title. I might be closer to this if I sort of could relate the changes to the comments a little better. But even then, I'd be left with a measure that I don't think I understand very well how it actually works in practice, if the voters approve it. So I got maybe three basic concerns: is compliance with the statutory requirement about highlighting the changes, compliance with the statutory requirement that the changes be in response to review and comment, or the measure should be resubmitted for review and comment, and third, just understanding the measure well enough to clearly express a single subject. I don't know. That's sort of where I am, but I'm curious where the other board members are. Mr. Eubanks.
Well, I think in terms of the jurisdictional issue, there hasn't been compliance with the statutory provision about filing the three different versions. The fact that there wasn't a marked-up version, that I think we lack the jurisdiction to set a title on that ground alone. I also agree that it's hard to know whether the changes are made in direct response without the marked-up version, to know whether or not there's been compliance with that requirement. And unfortunately, due to the internal inconsistencies within the measure, even if we got past the jurisdictional problems, I don't think I understand the measure well enough to be able to set a title. And so at whatever point you think it's proper, I'd be willing to make a motion that we not set a title on jurisdictional grounds.
Well, I think that's where I am. And I am mindful of the fact this is the last meeting for new measures for this upcoming election. But, my gut feeling is that this has too many problems. As you indicated, Ms. Eubanks, for us to go forward. Mr. Blue?
I'm of the same mind, and I'm reluctant because of the citizen process, and I think you've put a lot of thought into this. And my concern, frankly, this is the last chance, and if we don't set title today, you're not going to get on the ballot this year. I don't like that. Unfortunately, I feel like we don't have an option interpretation. And I would encourage you to work with some, maybe find some people who have done initiatives who can help you with it in the future, or work with the comment process earlier so you can kind of get it going sooner and get it to us before the last thing the next time, because I think that this, you clearly have an idea that, that you
yes,
think is
correct.
Important and you want to put before the voters. So that's kind of where I am.
Yeah, and although I am really concerned about this being the last meeting, I also don't think we can have two different standards, you know, one for earlier in the cycle and one for at the end.
I'm not sure it's about asking for different standards within the cycle. I mean, as I stated, I went in there and specifically said, okay, I have this. I understand that within my process and the people I've worked with, that things push back to the deadline. However, I went there, and if someone specifically told me, go to the state website and check X, Y, and Z, I had the time to do so. I mean, I was late today to this meeting by 30 minutes because I had some personal problems at home, and I was late because by 30 minutes because I built in an hour of extra time. If I hadn't have done that, I would have been an hour and a half late. I was there specifically asking, okay, show me something that will tell me how to do this, and I'll gladly go ahead and do that. And nobody said, go to the state website and do this. And I'm like, okay, sure, I'll be back at 2:30 or whatever, is, you know, 30 minutes before a deadline, because that's a safe way to play things.
It's pretty common for proponents to submit revised versions over and over again to the legislative staff before submitting for title setting, and I think it relates to this, because I think this one, I think probably you would have benefited from resubmitting it for another review and comment, because I think then some of the difficulties that you're hearing us ask about, I think, might have been ironed out in a second review and comment meeting. But in the attempt to try to get everything done and meet this deadline, I think it just did not benefit from enough review and comment, frankly. I think that probably, like I say, other proponents have started earlier in the cycle and have gotten, I think, revised versions that have improved their measures over time. But I think this still, I as Mr. Blue said, I think put a lot of thought in it, and you've got an idea in your head what you want to achieve, but I'm not sure that the language is really there right now. I think there's just too many questions to understand the measure well enough. So I'm not sure what I think it's time for a motion, and I'm not sure whether it should simply be that the board does not have jurisdiction to set a title, or whether we should focus on one or more reasons. Mr. Kneiser, do you have any comments?
Yes, I think you should list all of the reasons under which you're denying the, if that's how you go, so that if there's an appeal, the court will have sufficient understanding of why the jurisdiction was denied.
Well, I think I will make a motion then, and I want to be inclusive enough, and then if this is too broad, then there may need to be another motion, but I guess I would move that the board find that deny title setting on the basis of lack of jurisdiction because of lack of compliance with the highlighting requirement in Section 1-40-105, subsection 4. That's number one. Number two, for changes that are not in response to review and comment in compliance with Section 1-40-105, subsection 2. And because the board is unable to understand the measure well enough to clearly express a single subject. Now, is that motion meet what you were talking about, Mr. Kneiser? So I'll at least offer that motion and see if there's support for that motion.
I second it.
Okay, so that motion has been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. So that concludes action on number 114. The time is 4:07 p.m.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Let's move on to the next agenda item. This is agenda item number 18, which is 2007-2008, number 113, severance tax. The time is 4:08 p.m. Just want to note for the record a couple of things. The Office of State Planning and Budgeting provided a fiscal analysis for number 113, and copies are on the table, I believe. And in so doing, the board or the OSPB also revised their previous fiscal estimates for a couple of other severance tax proposals, number 68 and number 88. The other thing I want to note is now for this measure, and I think the remaining measures on our agenda, the Attorney General's designee is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General. So, Mr. Ramey, on behalf of proponents, any
Thank
comments?
You, Chairman Edward Ramey, on behalf of the proponents. I guess, for the pleasure of the board, however you'd like to proceed, probably the jurisdictional and single subject issues first. I would note this measure, as the board I'm sure recognizes, is very similar to perhaps a number of other measures. We have been back through review and comment in one iteration or another repeatedly, refining and revising these measures. This one bears marked resemblance to number 88, which we discussed a few weeks back, principal differences being some tinkering with percentages here and there, and also the elimination of the point of taxation change that was present in number 88 not present in there was a discussion with regard to 88 raising some single subject concerns. The board nevertheless proceeded to set a title with the understanding, I think, that we all have that some of the issues, particularly I know the concern Mr. Domenico, I think primarily, certainly are going to be addressed by the Supreme Court. I would be very surprised if we don't have a motion for rehearing and a Supreme Court appeal on this. That may happen, but I doubt it. Otherwise, I think the issues are largely identical to what was discussed before, and I would simply stop at that point. I do have some comments about the title, but if the board wishes to address the jurisdictional and single subject issues first, I would defer to and invite that.
Okay. Are there questions of Mr. Ramey about the measure? Ms. Eubanks?
Just because we've seen so many of these, I just want to double check to make sure that I'm understanding what this one does, because they sort of all get blurred in my mind.
In mine as well.
Okay. So this is modifying the existing tax starting January 1st, 2009. You have a stripper well exemption, but you're lowering sort of the standards for what qualifies for that exemption. Because this is in a separate paragraph, the ad valorem credit wouldn't apply.
And that is most important. The ad valorem credit applies to, it appears, appears in 105.2B. It applies to 1B.
Right.
So there is no ad valorem credit that would apply to new 1C, so there would be no ad valorem credit.
Okay.
And for the new, for the 1C tax.
Okay. And then in terms of the actual rate of taxation, that once you hit the $300,000 income, gross income threshold, 5% of total gross income is taxed.
Yes. So if you have not hit that level, there is
exempt.
No tax. Once you hit it, everything
is taxed.
Zero.
Okay.
Is subject to the 5% tax.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Amy? If not, then let's move on to question of compliance with the single subject requirement. Anybody wish to testify with respect to the question of single subject compliance? Not discussion by the board? Ms. Eubanks.
Similar to other measures that's been brought before the board and that we've set titles on, I believe this measure constitutes a single subject and believe that we should proceed to set a title.
And is that a motion?
I so move.
I'll second that. Discussion by the board. Mr. Domenico.
Well, I'll just incorporate kind of all the questions I've had on these in the past about both raising a tax and creating a bunch of new uses for the money that don't necessarily have much relationship either to the tax or the or each other, but in the past I voted on that, awaiting the guidance from the Supreme Court, and so I'll do the same here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, then all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. We'll turn to the staff drafts. Ms. Gomez has displayed the staff draft on the screen. Mr. Ramey, your comments on the staff draft?
We do have some minor tinkering changes I'd like to suggest, and what I've done is prepare sort of a black line version of the staff draft, and if I may approach it, I'd just like
sure.
to hand it to the board and to Mr. Gessler, who I know I'll be seeing in the future.
Okay.
Basically, I think the staff draft is quite good, and I'm going to reserve for a moment how to fill in the blank, because I did just see the fiscal estimate this afternoon.
Okay.
Here.
Go ahead.
Here's basically what I've attempted to do, and obviously it's the board's pleasure on this. The primary feature of the change that we are making to the severance tax itself. In other words, the feature that will generate the increased revenue stream for the most part, not in total, but for the most part, is the elimination of the property tax credit given to oil and gas producers and interest owners that Ms. Eubanks was just referring to. I mean, that just so happens that has the largest impact by far. I don't think the oil and gas industry would quibble with that statement. What I've attempted to do in this suggested revision is simply move that aspect of what's happening up a little earlier in the title, putting it at the list at the beginning of the string of things that are being affected, because that is certainly the greatest effect. And I've taken out what appeared to me to be some surplus language, modifying the existing severance tax on oil and gas extracted in the state by, sort of a precatory phrase. And I changed some semicolons to commas down later on, leaving that. that just as a string. So one suggestion that we would make is just to move the concept of eliminating the tax credit given to oil and gas producers and interest owners for property taxes paid a little earlier, because that is the primary effect that will generate the additional revenue. The only other thing, and I haven't noted it on the draft that I gave you, but one thing we could do, and we'd certainly be receptive of this if the board thinks that it would help in making this a little more readable, is there are a number of uses at the very end, starting with the uses for the funds that go to the Severance Tax Stabilization Trust Fund, starting with be used to fund scholarships for students state colleges, et cetera. We could put A, B, C, D in parentheses, I suppose, in front of each of those, just to break them up so that all those various concepts don't run together. But other than that, the staff draft is excellent, and we would have no other suggestions.
Thank you. Discussion of the titles, then. Again, I don't have anybody else signed up to testify, so I'm assuming there's no one. Okay, Ms. Eubanks.
I'm looking at the title that we set for 88, which, understanding the point of taxation is different and stuff, but it had the same concept of the 300,000, 5% of total gross income. And what concerns me, both in the staff draft as well as your modified staff draft, is the statement about exempting gross income below a specific dollar amount from the tax, because we didn't include that type of statement in 88, and it was the same sort of basic mechanism, and it's that difficulty of the fact that once you hit the $300,000 threshold, it's not exempt. It's everything's subject to tax. And whether or not perhaps the staff draft on 88 was drafted that way and we took it out, but that's one concern.
May I respond to that, Ms. Eubanks?
Sure.
But I struggle with exactly that when I was looking at this. And I think what makes the difference here, and it may have been in 88 as well, I just don't recall, but the way it is worded is exempting gross income below a specified dollar amount, not exempting income. And going back and forth in my own mind, it seemed that with the word gross in there, that is what this does. If gross income is under, I'm defending the staff here for no particular reason, I guess, but if gross income is below that level, it is exempt. Once gross income is above that level, it's not. That's what sort of brought me to the point of thinking the staff draft was okay. So I have no objection to making it clear.
And even though we didn't include that provision in earlier versions that had that same concept.
I was suppressing earlier versions.
I know. Like I said, it's hard to keep it straight. Another thing that is a concern of mine, but both on the staff draft and your modified staff draft, is it never talks about modifying the tax rate and whether or not we should include something about that, because I do agree the elimination of the ad valorem credit, the changing of the minimal production for the stripper wells, those are important concepts. But I think also the fact that you're getting away from the graduated rate system of the current tax and going to sort of a flat rate, and that's not referred to in either of these versions. And so that's another concern of mine in terms of sort of the big ticket items. I've got some little things about how we describe the purposes, but whether you have any response about a statement on modifying the tax rate?
One could certainly be inserted. We wouldn't have any objection to that. I think the thought, in my mind at least, as I was reading the staff draft, was note that the maximum rate, the 5% that we're using, is the maximum rate that exists under the current structure. just the lower graduated rates that are being eliminated, in fact reduced to zero until gross income is up to that level.
Would you think do you think that that's then covered by the phrase about exempting gross income below a specific dollar amount from the tax? Do you think that's reflective of that?
I think so, but I don't feel so strongly about that that I would quibble with the board if you wanted to add a phrase about modifying the tax rates. We are going to a flat rate at a level that equals the maximum rate that existed. I'm completely deferential to the board's pleasure on that.
Make a suggestion,
Mr. Domenico.
That might, in some ways, address both of those concerns, although it doesn't, I don't think, gets across the idea, the way I have it in mind, of what the changes are, but it's going to be hard, I think, to get across both the changes and the new version without making it very long. But my idea would be, instead of the language about just exempting gross income below a specified dollar amount, say something along the lines of setting the rate of taxation at 5% of gross income above $300,000 or something like that. Gets across, tells you what the new rate is. It doesn't tell you what the changes are. I don't know if it's clear enough on that point about that. What happens below that, I think by implication, if that's the tax rate. But maybe we could fix it to make that part a little bit clearer. But something like that gets across both of those points, although neither one perfectly clearly.
I would be good with that in terms of that approach. Oh,
Mr. Gessler.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name is, for the record, Scott Gessler. I represent Colorado Petroleum Association. I apologize, but I guess I can't keep from getting up to the podium. If I may make a suggestion here, it seems as though there is not an exemption on gross income. Rather, it's an exemption on producers. So certain producers who meet particular criteria, those are the ones that are exempt rather than the income. Because if a producer exceeds a certain threshold, all of that producer's income is taxed. So it's really not an exemption on income. It's an exemption on specific producers that meet thresholds as measured by their income and their income production.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think my proposal is accurate in that sense. It would have to be slightly changed. Say something more like applying the tax at a rate of 5% of gross income for producers with $300,000 or over in gross income. I think would.
And if I remember correctly, I'm sorry. If I remember correctly, and I don't have it in front of me, there's two criteria. It's the, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the 300,000, but it seems as though there's also another criterion, one other criterion, which is an alternate, either 7.5 barrels per day, less than 7.5 barrels per day average production. I think it was 40,000 cubic feet per day average of production days, not calendar days, but production days. So the days in which it's in production, it has to be less than that. And I don't have the language in front of me because I jumped up there. But if I remember correctly, there were sort of two criteria.
Yeah, I think that aspect of it is what's the next clause about changing the definition of minimal production or something like that. I don't know if it's really a definition, but it's changing that exception. It is 7.5 barrels a day or 5,000 cubic feet of gas or less. I think that's what that aspect of it's getting at. Maybe this is why we just took it out in 88. But it does strike me that telling people what the tax is going to be is probably valuable. Maybe we could incorporate those two other exceptions into the sentence that I was proposing and get rid of that other one and just sort of say, applying the tax at a rate of 5% of total gross income for producers with over $300,000 or over of gross income. And accepting oil produced from wells I guess you could be more general accepting oil produced minimally oil and gas from produced from minimally what did we use minimally wells with minimal production. Then you could get rid of that next sentence. I don't know.
Here, can I throw one other
Mr. Amy?
Little spider in the suggestion you're making, I have no quibble with. But it's more than producers paying the tax. Probably easier to leave it the way the staff draft is in terms of because it is income tax, but if you decide to refer to other interest owners. But otherwise, you're circling around statements that I think fine with, as long as this doesn't get so convoluted and twisted up in itself that it becomes unreadable, which I think is always the fear.
Well, I think maybe we could just remove the reference producers entirely and just say that applying the tax at a rate of 5%
been scribbling. I don't know if it would be helpful.
Ms. Eubanks?
It doesn't really incorporate the stripper well issue yet. I was just playing around with trying to describe the tax, and perhaps the way it's described might help eliminate the reference about whether you're exempting gross income. But whether you say something like imposing a tax at a rate of 5% of total gross income, I don't know whether you need to say from the sale of oil and gas, when the amount of annual gross income exceeds not really exceeds because it equals or exceeds annual gross income is at least $300,000. So I don't know if that I know that Mr. Ramey wanted to eliminate modifying the existing severance tax on oil and gas extracted. Whether or not, and I don't know if, how the other board members feel about that, but we could start by perhaps striking that entire first phrase that starts modifying. All the way through from the tax on line 5. Insert imposing a tax, imposing a tax at a rate of 5%, do the with the percentage sign, of total, let's say, instead of say on total, on total gross income from the sale of oil and gas when the amount of annual gross income is at least $300,000. We can talk about placement. I don't know, to me, you know, sort of the basics of the tax is more important than sort of which provision is going to generate the most revenue. I mean, at least from my perspective, it seems like if you're talking about the tax and you're changing the tax, that in terms of the tax rate, that perhaps that might be the first thing, but I'm open to that. We can always change that. And then I think it would be a comma or a semicolon after. I don't know whether we need to throw in there that it's oil and from the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state or not. Doesn't help at all. I'm okay with that.
I like everything you did. I was just thinking about the extracted in the state question. I wonder if there's a concern that without it in there, people get the impression that the guys running the gas station and everybody else who's selling...
Or people that are buying gas?
Yeah, selling oil and gas.
So maybe
you end up paying the tax anyway, wherever you impose it.
But the point of taxation is... So on line 6, Ceci, I think after oil and gas, you want to insert on line 6, after oil and gas, insert extracted in the state.
Can't we say severed from the earth? I just love that language.
I'm okay with that too. I don't feel strongly. This is severance tax.
Well, you know, technically, when you go to the gas station, gas is in those underground storage tanks, so aren't you extracting it from
you pump it out?
Shoving it from the earth, so I don't not be getting any clearer. Either one of them is helpful, though.
Right.
No, I like the way you've got it now.
Talk about eliminating the credit, changing, and I don't think it's the definition, but, I mean, we'll deal with this change first and then go to placement, but I would move this change.
I second that change.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks.
On line 8, I don't think it's really changing the definition of minimal production, whether it's changing the level of minimal production to change the word definition to level. You have minimal production twice. You just say the level of production for purposes of the exemption for wells with minimal production. To strike that first minimal.
Yeah, and what if you all, instead of for purposes, said the level of production that qualifies for the exemption for wells with minimal production? Delete for purposes of and insert that qualifies for. Or an, I don't. I would put an and delete v.
On lines 8 and 9.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks.
So, Mr. Ramey, in terms of the credit language, recognizing the need to talk about producers and interest owners, I mean, that it's incorrect now just to reference producers. If we said eliminating a credit against the tax, I'm trying to use your language, but to say a tax credit, it doesn't really give you a reference to which tax the credit's being allowed against, which is the severance tax. And so I was trying to tie it in more in terms of the series, since we're talking about a tax. And that's why it's written the way it is now, about eliminating a credit against the tax based on property taxes paid by oil and gas producers and interest owners. Would that be helpful? Or
yeah, I mean, I think Ms. Eubanks said that gets to the same point.
Okay. Well, I think it would be basically the language that's there, that starts on line 7, and then on line 8, before producers, on line 8, go down one, before producers, insert oil and gas. And then after producers, insert and interest owners. Yes, and interest owners.
Could you accomplish the same thing just by stopping after paid and deleting the rest of that? Because isn't the only people who pay the credit are oil and gas producers, and the only people who pay the severance tax are oil and gas producers and interest owners. And so the only people who get the credit are the people who pay the tax, and I don't know if it's necessary to keep it in there. It's just a thought to get rid of some language instead of add some.
I like it in there because it is. And this is a credit received by the taxpayers. The only thing I might do with that phrase is longer, but severance tax.
One, and I guess the reason, I'm sorry.
Keep going.
The reason in terms of, if you look at the first phrase, imposing a tax, we don't call it a severance tax there. So to just call it the tax here, because, I mean, you've got severance tax in your single subject statement, and then all the references just being to the tax, and we probably need one for the exemption statement for an exemption from the tax for wealth and animal production. But that's my thought in terms of just since you already have the single subject being severance tax, that then you don't have to say severance tax all the time as you're going through the...
I guess my only concern with this phrase was we're talking about two taxes in one phrase.
Oh, okay. To distinguish property versus severance.
But...
Well, I'm okay with that. So, on line 7, for tax, severance. I would move that change.
The motion is to make all those changes on 7, 8, and 9. Is that what we're...
30,
or no, 7 and 8.
Did we do the stripper well already?
I think we did. The part we haven't voted on, I think, is
the
severance,
issue.
Oil and gas, and interest owners.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would move the changes on line 7 and 8. Elimination of the credit for property taxes paid.
Can I just make one suggestion that
sure.
is actually based on how you just phrased it, which is instead of saying based on property taxes, you said for property taxes, and that is how I would say it.
Sorry, based on? Substitute for. Uh-huh. Renew my motion.
Second. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks.
And I'm back to the stripper well exemption, whether we need to say on line 9 after exemption from the tax. Tax. Otherwise, they might not know the context of the exemption.
So then that would read changing the level of production that qualifies for an exemption from the tax. Okay.
Then it splits up the descriptor for the exemption, which is the I think it's okay.
Could we?
Go ahead.
Let me make a suggestion. Change that whole mess to saying something like changing the level of production that qualifies a minimally producing well or a well with minimal production for an exemption from the tax.
So maybe if you take the phrase for wells with minimal production and moves it up?
Yeah, it would have to be changed a little bit more than that, but yeah, basically. So it would be changing the level of production that qualifies a well with minimal production for an exemption from the tax.
Okay.
That's easier to read.
Jesse doesn't know what to
So on line 9, after that qualifies, which is something we inserted earlier, before that.
After qualifies.
After qualifies and before 4, insert that qualifies. I don't know if we want to use the plural or a singular well or wells, a well or wells. One.
Qualifies.
I say
singular? A well.
That was what I said. The measure is written in the plural. I think both are accurate. I'm tempted to use the language from the measure.
Sure.
So it would be that qualifies wells with minimal production for an exemption from the tax up to the semicolon.
Is it simpler and still accurate? Can we eliminate that phrase qualifies wells with minimal production? Could we just say changing the minimal level of production that qualifies wells for an exemption from the tax? I mean, it seems a little redundant to me, but maybe I'm missing something. So my question would be, can we say changing the minimum level of production?
It's actually a maximum level of production. Maybe if you changed it to the maximum level,
then it
would make sense.
Okay, never mind.
That's the problem, is the minimal level suggests sort of wrong thing.
Well, okay, so minimum level of production that qualifies for the tax.
But it's the maximum level that qualifies. Yeah, well,
it's for you
right.
Qualifying for the exemption or for the tax?
Yeah, well, no, if you said it that way, I think that's right. The minimum, changing the minimum level that qualifies a well. Well, it's really that qualifies the income attributable to a well to the tax.
Well, if we're okay with what we've got on the screen. I'm not trying to make trouble.
Well, it's not poetry, but I don't know that we're in that business at all.
Well, I mean, could we just drop with minimal production? And I think it might also be important to change the word changing to reducing, because that's what the measure's doing. It's restricting the exemption. But if we just say reducing the level of production that qualifies wells for an exemption from the tax, whether that gives sufficient notice. and helps simplify it a little bit.
Sounds pretty good to me, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty good. It that doesn't really get across the idea that this exemption is for small wells, but I don't know if that's... It's kind of obvious, and to the extent it's not obvious, it's not important. That's the only thing that saying it that way doesn't get across.
Well, I guess although it's not the terminology of the measure, you could say low-producing wells, but I don't know if that gets the concept across any better than with minimal production.
Yeah, small wells is, I'm sure, just totally inaccurate as a matter of
I don't know the size of the well versus how much it produces.
Technology, yeah, but either. It seems that...
But with the changing to reducing, because it is restricting the exemption.
Would the proponents object to something along the lines of what Ms. Eubank suggested of just reducing the level of production that qualifies wells for an exemption from the tax? Would the proponents object to that?
No. Actually, I'm enjoying watching the board struggle with this.
Right?
I'm sure you are. No, I think the proponents would be fine with the Eubank's suggestion, and I don't know how to say that concept better. I really don't.
Well, if the proponents are okay with it, I think I'm okay with it.
We could say our favorite certain wells.
Yes. That qualifies certain wells.
Which helps a lot.
That qualifies wells for an exemption. Yeah, I think that is accurate. It's not misleading. It doesn't, as I said, capture the concept of small or low-producing wells, but if the proponents are okay with not capturing that, that doesn't seem to rise to the level of materiality that causes me a problem.
So I would move the additional changes that we've made on lines 8 and 9 and 10 regarding the stripper well exemption.
Second, so that it now would read reducing the level of production that qualifies wells for an exemption from the tax.
Yes.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks.
Mr. Chair, may I insert something? You were about, I think, to go on to other aspects of the measure. And I may be out of order because I'm about to comment on a change that was made that...
Go ahead.
I tried to reach out and it zoomed by me. Actually, two things. One, the phrase up in line 5, imposing a tax at the rate of 5%, makes it sound a little bit like we're adopting a whole new tax. And what we're really not, we're changing a tax that currently exists in various ways. And I guess what I would propose for the board's consideration is maybe using the words revising the tax rate to 5% and going ahead. Because we're not really imposing a new tax, we're revising a current rate structure.
In light of your comment, I mean, you had previously suggested striking the language modifying the existing severance tax on oil and gas extracted in the state that was in the staff draft. So, sort of going back that way, but not...
Well, the way...
I agree. You are modifying the existing tax rather than imposing an entirely new tax.
And we could use the word modifying. I do want to come back... The way that phrase appeared initially was sort of a prefatory phrase, and then a whole lot of things followed it. Now,
right.
it's morphing into something a little bit different. What seems important is the word imposing seems to be misleading. Modifying or revising, either one would work, given the new language.
But to do that, then you have to change the structure of the phrase a little bit, because if you just say revising a tax at a rate, I mean...
Revising a tax to 5%?
Maybe you say revising the tax to a rate a 5%.
Could you just say setting the tax at a rate of, or setting the tax rate at, I mean, that doesn't quite go as far. It gets rid of imposing. It doesn't quite go as far as actually saying revising the tax, but it, to me, gets across the idea that you're not imposing a new tax, but you're changing the tax rate. You're setting the existing tax at a new rate.
Mr. Gessler?
May I suggest the word increase?
Well,
it is in fact because all of the income less than $300,000 is now taxed at 5% as well.
Increase
only if you meet the threshold.
It's increasing the tax, but it's not increasing the tax rate, which is what we're talking about. And I sure wish that they would have exempted the $300,000, even if you make $300,001, just because it would have solved a lot of our problems that we've had so far.
And although I would argue that it is increasing the tax rate for the amounts that are less than $300,000, if the, and we have that modifier in there later, if the well is over, you know, produces over certain thresholds and the income's over a certain threshold, and I would also argue that that is significant because, you know, well County alone has 12,000 wells, and they ain't the size of Saudi Arabian wells. They're little wells that produce small amounts, so that this actually is very meaningful.
Well, you get increase in there in the first sentence, and it would really require a lot of rewriting to say it again.
I won't die on my sword.
What?
I just wanted to make that comment.
If we perhaps change the beginning of that phrase to changing the rate of the tax to 5% on total gross income, changing or modifying the rate of the tax?
That's fine, the two things from our perspective. And we're trying to get it doesn't increase the tax.
Ms. Eubanks.
Okay, so why don't we delete imposing a tax at a rate of...
I'm going to delete everything.
Yeah, I think it's easier for you that way. And say changing the rate of the tax, H in the... I would move that change.
Second. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Mr. Chair, I guess my second point before you go on to the next. I would like to make one more pitch, it's when I got lost, about moving the one concept forward. And by the way, I'm happy with the wording that draft, eliminating, which starts on line 7, eliminating a credit against the severance tax. Again, I think, Ms. Eubanks, I would totally agree with your comment from a statutory drafting perspective. The order in which things are now appearing in the draft is probably preferable manner. For the sake of a title, however, the impact, the thing that's going to generate the bulk of the increased revenue stream, which is what this whole thing is about, is the elimination of that credit. And just to highlight that for purposes of voters reading a ballot title, my suggestion would be, and then I'm going to shut up about this, but my suggestion would be to take your phrase that now appears on line 7 and 8 and move it up to front of the stuff that begins on line 5, changing the tax rate. Elimination of the credit is a whole lot more important to what's going on here than
still where I was. I think that
I'm okay with it. Sorry to interrupt. No. I'm okay with it either way, I think. I understand why that is. I would definitely would agree. Well, I think they're both important points, and especially given the fact that it, in addition to adjusting the rate, does adjust the income that it applies to, the 5% applies to. It's pretty important for some people. So I'm okay either way. One of those things where there are a number of right ways to do it. So I'm willing to defer to the rest of the board on that point.
Yeah, I'm okay, I think, with it for now anyway.
Okay.
Ms. Eubanks?
Then in terms of some other changes, down, and it's dealing with the laundry list of purposes for which the Severance Tax Stabilization Trust Fund can be used for, I would suggest striking students and saying Colorado residents, because I do believe that the scholarships can only be given to Colorado residents rather than just any students, and I think that's an important concept to get across. I would strike students, substitute Colorado residents. I would move that change.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks.
In terms of the monies that go to the Clean Energy Fund, which in the measure it just has a cross-reference to the statute. And so looking at the statute, it talks about that the monies in the fund are used for enhancing renewable energy and energy efficiency. It doesn't have a reference to clean energy. And so I would suggest changing this phrase a little bit so that before renewable, to insert enhancements in, and after renewable, insert energy. And strike clean, strike projects, and substitute efficiency. Now, what that means exactly, I don't know, but it tracks the language of the statute, and I'm a little bit more comfortable with that than the way the staff draft had phrased it, so that it would be used to fund enhancements in renewable energy and energy efficiency. I would move that change.
I'll second that. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
And then my last issue, and this is a question for Mr. Ramey, in terms of the water grants, the measure talks about small community drinking water and domestic wastewater treatment, and I don't know whether those concepts are important as distinguishing from, I guess, larger community drinking water grants or, I don't know, commercial wastewater treatment. I don't know, and so I just didn't know if that's significant or not.
For title purposes, I guess.
Okay.
Well, that's the wrong term to use there in terms of adding concept on top of concept. So, I mean, I think
okay.
That phrase.
Okay. I think good. Other than we got to fill in the number.
Can I, let me ask about semicolons, commas, and the conjunction on line 8. I think Well, let me start with that. Towards the end of line 8, it says, and reducing the level of production. Is that and supposed to be there now?
Oh. Probably not, because I think that was part of the tie-in with the modifying the existing severance tax language at the beginning, because there was a series of different ways it was being modified.
Okay. Well, let me maybe...
Should be a semicolon.
Yeah.
Or is it a semicolon?
I think there's several. I just want... Let's go through it and make sure we've got semicolon. I think we're inconsistent right now, and I think Mr. Ramey pointed that out in his suggestions. But as we have it right now, the first thing is, I think, the first clause is after the in connection with is changing the rate of tax. So we need, I think there is a semicolon line 7 after $300,000, so that's okay. The next one is eliminating a credit. That where the cursor is that should be a semicolon. Okay, then reducing the level. That line 10, we need a semicolon.
Is that a semicolon there? Did it look okay?
Exempting revenues from the tax. Then on line 11, after government spending limits, that's a semicolon. Okay. And everything else is the remaining clause, I think. Okay, so I'll move those changes. Not sure what they are, but
Mr. Dominic.
Second.
Second your motion.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then in line 1, the amount of the increase, Mr. Ramey.
We did just receive this afternoon, Mr. Chairman, the OSPB estimate, and it looks like they give a range, quite a range. From $237.4 million up to $321.4 million, and recommend that we use the higher figure. That would be acceptable to the proponents to put in the $321.4
million. So $321.4 million. I guess I'll move that change. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes?
Well, I'll reiterate my suggestion that while I think doing it in this format is sufficient, I think we would do our job better, especially in this instance, to include the specific percentages, because in this instance it's especially confusing, the measure, because it has two sets of percentages, and also the way it's written doesn't make it clear to me necessarily that all the sub parts of what's within number 3, the stabilization trust fund, each have their own specified percentage, and so if it were up to me, we would be including those percentages in all these measures. But as I say, I think it's sufficient without it, and given that I've never convinced another member of the board to agree with me on that, I'm just mentioning it in the hopes that someone changed their mind.
Well, you may be right, but I think I'm okay with it as is.
Next cycle, maybe.
Someday. Then I'll move that the board adopt the staff draft as amended. Oh, sorry, Mr. Call. Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Ryan Call with the firm of Zach and Matherton. Just two maybe observations for the board's consideration before you adopt the measure as a whole, for kind of clarity's sake. On line 12, with reference after paren 1, the state severance tax trust fund. In the statute, that fund is actually just referred to as the severance tax trust fund, 3929109, not the state severance tax trust fund. I'm not sure if that's critical, but I know that Legislative Legal Services has in the past identified that you want to identify the funds with some specificity. If that's the title of that fund is in fact the Severance Tax Trust Fund, not the State Severance Tax Trust Fund. I guess the only other observation I might make for clarity and making sure that you're consistent with the way the statutory regime treats this, I'm wondering if it would be appropriate for the board to consider inserting the words ad valorem in advance of the word property taxes online, since that is how that term is referred to in 3929106, parent 2. You see where I'm at there? It's an ad valorem property tax, and the fiscal note refers to that concept of an ad valorem property tax as well. And I just wondered if clarity, consistency, and harmony with the statutory regime, whether those two things ought not to be considered for the... Does that make sense?
I think so. Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the reference in the measure itself, where it talks about 22% being credited to the Severance Tax Trust Fund in 3929109, so I believe we should remove the reference, the word state, there where the cursor is. I would move that change.
Can I just ask, I understand the reasoning, but is it inaccurate to call it the State Severance Tax Trust Fund? Because without that, it's a little odd to say the Severance Tax Trust Fund and then the local government severance tax. I guess that's tax fund. The only issue I have with taking it out is that it's kind of just floating out there with no real... In the measure, it's described by the statute, by the reference to the statute. And so I think the use of state there is standing in as kind of our interpretation of what the statutory reference in the measure means. And I think I'd be okay with removing it, because now that I look at it, it's a little... It wouldn't be as awkward as I first thought to remove that and then leave the local government severance tax fund in the next line. And so I guess I'm okay either way.
Ms. Eubanks?
Well, both of those funds are technically state funds. I mean, they're both created in the state treasury. I think that the local government severance tax fund, and I don't have my Title 39, but I know that that money goes out to local governments. I wouldn't be surprised if even monies in the Severance Tax Trust Fund go out to local governments. Did it, is all state? Is it the...
I do have the state.
I, you know, in terms of...
3929. All the local government.
But the state... Oh.
Mr. Call.
Ryan Call, for the record. The reference under paren 2, that fund is in fact called a local government severance tax fund. That's what the title is.
But it is created in the state treasury.
That's correct. Created in the state treasury pursuant to 3929110 versus the one under paren 1 is the severance tax trust fund created by 3929109. Is the name of the fund, absent state.
And I guess I think that we should just be using the names of the funds as they've been created.
Ms. Eubanks, Mr. Chair, if I may try to respond to Ms. Eubanks' question, I do have the statute here, and I don't think that the Severance Tax Trust Fund
goes out to the local.
Does go to
okay.
Local.
See, I can't even keep it straight.
Things,
okay. It goes to state entities. Oh, okay. But I still think we should be using the name of the correct name of the fund.
Okay, then I would support that. I appreciate Mr. Domenico pointing out maybe that was the drafter was intending to distinguish the funds, but I think with that explanation, I'm okay with that change suggested by Ms. Eubanks. I'll second that motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. What?
Forgot.
That motion carries 3-0 anyway.
Slow.
So the other suggestion was... referring to the ad valorem property tax, I believe. Ms. Eubanks?
And my thought is that I don't know that ad valorem adds a lot to most folks, that I think most if they know anything about property tax, they know the reference to property tax rather than ad valorem, and I'm okay with just leaving it as property tax.
I think I'm okay, too. It seemed like we might have talked about that at some point, but there, if there's no motion, I suggest we just leave that. Okay. And if there's no other suggestions, then...
can we because we've done so much.
Yeah, and here's Ms. Gomez is showing it on the screen, and I think I'm just going to read it into the record as well, since we've been so choppy and making changes. So the title, as it reads right now, is state taxes shall be increased $321.4 million annually by an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the severance tax on oil and gas extracted in the state, in connection therewith, for taxable years commencing on or after January 1, 2009, changing the rate of the tax to 5% on total gross income from the sale of oil and gas extracted in the state when the annual amount of, when the amount of annual gross income is at least $300,000, semicolon, eliminating a credit against the severance tax for property taxes paid by oil and gas producers and interest owners, reducing the level of production that qualifies wells for an exemption from the tax, exempting revenues from the tax and related investment income from state and local government spending limits, and requiring specified percentages of the tax revenues to be credited to, paren 1, the severance tax trust fund, paren 2, the local government severance tax fund, and paren 3, the severance tax stabilization trust fund, which the measure creates to be used to fund scholarships for Colorado residents attending state colleges and universities, the preservation of native wildlife habitat, enhancements in renewable energy and energy efficiency, transportation projects in counties and municipalities impacted by the severance tax, the severance of oil and gas, and community drinking water and wastewater treatment grants. Ms. Eubanks?
Line 4, where we're talking about changing the rate, whether it should be 5% of total gross income instead of on.
That would read, changing the rate of the tax to 5% of total.
Okay. I would move that change.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And I'll move that the staff draft, that we adopt the staff draft as amended.
Second.
Any further discussion? And the understanding is the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 113. The time is 5:20 p.m. We have two more measures on our agenda. Do we want to take a break?
I'm okay.
Okay, let's go on then to the next agenda item, number 120. Okay, let's proceed then with 2007-2008, number 120, severance tax, transportation. Just for the record, the time is 5:21 p.m. Mr. Call, on behalf of proponents.
Keith. Mr. Hobbs, it's a pleasure to be with you again. For the record, Ryan Call with the firm of Zach and Atherton on behalf of the proponents. And if the board would like, I'm happy to address some of the jurisdictional questions first before we start talking about specifically the staff draft, if that would be helpful.
Are there any questions about the measure? Can I just ask one question on page 2, line 12? In subsection 2, the measure creates the Colorado Transportation Trust Fund. It says the General Assembly may appropriate revenue, giving first priority to relieving congestion in the Interstate 70 corridor. Could you just explain a little bit more about what that means? What does it mean to give first priority? I mean, is there other does that mean that priority has to be fully funded first? Is that just does it have any operative effect or any legally binding effect? Is it just signaling a principle?
Sure. And this kind of that whole question was explored at length in connection with the legislative review and comment hearing. The intent of the proponents is that the measure create essentially a legislative impairment, a legislative imperative, as well as a source of funding to address congestion on the I-70 corridor, but also really explicitly to empower the General Assembly with the funds necessary to bring about needed improvements, but to defer to the discretion, essentially, of the General Assembly with respect to how those funds and specific projects and appropriate measures designed to improve the I-70 corridor will be addressed. I mean, it really is the intent of the proponents to empower the legislature with kind of this legislative imperative, but not to micromanage or specifically dictate how and when and at what point has that congestion been appropriately relieved. Sort of defer that to the General Assembly, in that sense. And this was discussed, again, quite a bit at the review and comment hearing. The proponents envisioned that there would be quite a number of different ways that congestion could be relieved on the I-70 corridor, not necessarily including just expenditures directly on that roadway. It could potentially also involve expenditures for alternative routes or different east-west corridors or other things, as well as to kind of clarify that the I-70 corridor includes, in fact, the entire roadway between Utah and the Kansas borders. It's not just a particular segment on that designed to cover the entire east-west corridor, if that helps clarify.
I think so. So as I understand it, legally the monies can be expended for any purposes identified under Section 18 of Article 10, but the legislature ought to give high importance to the I-70 corridor.
That's precisely what it is.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a recognition that needs to be a legislative priority. That's what the measure and the funding was originally is intended to be used for, but to grant discretion to the General Assembly to figure out how best and to what extent that those objectives get met and the funds get allocated.
Okay. Ms. Eubanks?
Mr. Call, my question relates to the cap on the severance tax trust fund, and as I understand it, it's the amount you take previous year's amount adjusted for inflation, or the amount. I mean, it talks about the highest amount credited to the severance tax trust fund in any state fiscal year beginning July 1st, 2007. Well, I only know of one state fiscal year that starts on July 1st, 2007. So is it the last year's amount adjusted for inflation or the 2007 amount, whichever is greater? Is that what's intended?
The intent of the proposal, and we think the language actually reflects, the intent is to be able to not impose a ratchet down effect based on the previous years, to basically say it's the whatever the previous year was plus inflation or whatever the previous allocation to the severance tax fund in all years sort of beginning including the present fiscal year beginning from the 07-08. Does that answer your question?
question.
Well, you just said all fiscal years, and it says, you know, it, although it says any fiscal year, it says any fiscal year beginning July 1, 2007, and I only know that there's one year.
I think I understand.
I mean, usually you say beginning on or after or something. It just says beginning July 1st, 2007. And so that's what my question is. Is that what the cap is? It's either previous year adjusted for inflation or the amount that goes to the severance tax trust fund in 2007, whichever amount is greater, based on the language of the measure.
I appreciate the insightful comment. The language is intended to cover any of the succeeding fiscal years beginning with the year 2008.
Even though it may not say
if
that?
It says any. I mean, the intent of the language was to infer, you know, any state fiscal year, including the year beginning in 2007. As you point out, there may be some ambiguities with respect to that particular language. I'm not sure if the board has within its authority kind of a technical correction with respect to that, something that the proponents would certainly be supportive of. You've referenced that language. It certainly is intended to, and the proponents believe that the language was drafted to accomplish the end of that and any succeeding years, if that makes sense.
So one way of reading it, as I think you might be suggesting, is beginning July 1, 2007, it would be any fiscal year, whatever amount is transferred, credited to the severance tax trust fund in that fiscal year.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Then let's turn to a question with measures compliance with single subject. Any discussion about whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement? Ms. Eubanks?
I believe the measure comprises a single subject and that we should proceed to set a title.
I agree. Representative McNulty, you had also signed up to testify. Do you want to comment at this point? Okay, thank you. Did you make that motion,
Ms. Eubanks? I would be happy to make that as a motion.
I'll second that. Any discussion? If not, all of
I guess I should just say I've got my same issue with this I do with all the severance tax things we've seen. Not enough to overcome
liberal interpretation
of the process.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff draft, which Ms. Gomez has displayed on the screen in the room. Mr. Call, comments about the staff draft?
If I might, I have prepared a couple of redline version comparing the staff draft with some suggestions that the proponents might want.
Okay. Thank you.
We've distributed that, and copies are available. With respect to specific suggestions, one of the important components in the measures, or an observation really rather regarding its effect and intent, is that the measure does not raise or modify or impose any new taxes or tax rates, nor does the measure exempt revenues for any current from any current constitutionally imposed limits on state revenues. So kind of an important observation is that this is addressing simply the allocation of the revenue stream with respect to severance taxes in the state. So the proponents would propose a insertion of a comment and a clarification to the voters without raising taxes. It would be something we'd like to have inserted online in the staff draft that you have in front of you. Be in connection with after the word are extracted in the state on line 3. In the proponent's proposed ballot title, I did delete a comma after that second and, but it's in sort of retrospect, we probably need to keep that in there as a parenthetical. We've also proposed, as was discussed with the previous measure, that the word state be stricken in reference to the state severance tax trust fund, which is referenced in line, the last word in line 5, and also a suggestion that to provide some clarity to the voters with respect to what is that annually calculated limit, a proposed alternative to read annual inflation adjusted limit, provide some clarity to the voters. We don't necessarily quibble with what the staff has prepared with respect to the calculation, but we thought it important to provide some clarity to the voters as to what is the basis for that calculation, if that makes sense. And those three suggestions and changes, that's really all the modifications the proponents would move.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask, I mean, that's an interesting suggestion on to include the phrase without raising taxes. I mean, just to be a little difficult, we don't normally say what a measure doesn't do. But did you say your primary purpose is to distinguish this measure from others, or
not the purpose of the measure, but in order, we recognizing that there will be, as has been observed, a number of different measures on the ballot. Our objective as the proponents is to provide some clarity as to how this measure may be different than others, and it really is kind of out of the gate the intent and purpose of the proposal not to raise taxes, just simply to address the concept of where the revenue stream gets allocated. So the proponents believe that it really is an important component, the fact that it doesn't raise taxes, if that makes sense, the absence of.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the concerns, of course, is that we would be inserting a selling point, basically. I appreciate where you're coming from, but, I mean, we don't normally insert in measures when they don't raise taxes that they don't raise taxes. I mean, we have said in the staff draft that the subject is concerning the distribution, and there's no language that indicates that there's an actual tax increase. A little concerned about whether it's warranted to distinguish this measure by saying it's doing these things without raising taxes. I don't know.
I have the same concern, but I also think that Mr. Call makes a good point that really is a material aspect of this, and the measure said in it, there shall be no increase in tax rates or something like that. We probably would put that in the title. I just don't know. I mean, it's not a catchphrase, like something people might... Well, it seems like something people would certainly find to be a material point, but at the same time, I agree, it's a bit different from what I think we typically do. I wonder... I mean, I would probably be okay with putting it in there, I think, if everyone agreed. On the other hand, I'd probably be okay leaving it out. There are many, many ways to write a title that I think satisfy our view. You know, one compromise might be in line 2 to from the existing state severance tax across the idea that I don't know. That's my feeling.
I'm probably just reluctant to do that, but strongly about it. Ms. Eubanks?
I'm also reluctant to do that because I agree that our general practice has been not to include in the title something that the measure doesn't do. Now, I may be, in terms of saying existing, you know, concerning the distribution of revenues realized from the existing state severance tax, I'm fine with that, but to me, without raising taxes, that's more of a selling point than anything else. It's not based on the the text
and
of
I mean
the measure, and so. But I'd be happy. I think it would be accurate to say the existing state severance tax.
It's just, I think the proponents might, if we were to make that change, even though, as I said, I think it would be a with our authority to make the suggested change. I'm not sure I would, if I were the proponents, trust the Supreme Court to agree with me on that point, and that would pose a risk to them that the measure would be thrown out for something that's sort of a, not a catchphrase, but it is something like a selling point rather than a description of the measure. So I think we're all leaning towards trying to not quite make that change, but maybe I suggest we do include existing on line two. Besides that point, without going over the top, Mr. Call.
Certainly, no one interrupt the discussion. The measure specifically does reference the existing provisions, the existing position of taxing regime pursuant to Article 29 of 39, and so opponents believe that this concept of it doesn't impose a new tax is an important one. I think it's a very accurate and appropriate description to reference that it's an existing tax, state severance tax, rather than any new taxes or new regimes, because that is really spelled out in the proposal. It's referencing the current and existing severance taxes imposed pursuant to existing state law. So we, as the proponents, would be supportive of inserting the word existing prior to the word state severance tax, so realize from the existing state severance tax.
Why don't I move then that we make that addition to line from and the state?
It would probably be after, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
From existing.
It's been a long day for these folks.
Yeah.
I second that.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Can I ask, related to that, Mr. Call, does it help at all, instead of saying, and I'm just wondering if it helps the signal what's going on here, if instead of using the word distribution, we use the word allocation? I don't think it means any different, but I'm just wondering, do you get any different sense if we said concerning the allocation of revenues?
I think it does help communicate to the voters that you're allocating something you've got already, and it doesn't change. So we would we don't have a strong feeling one way or the other,
yeah.
But I think it could suggest to the mind of the voters, okay, you're allocating something you've already got that's existing rather than distributing. I'm not sure if there's a sort of drafting convention with respect to how revenues are distributed or allocated. But it does, I think, suggest to the mind that we've got these funds. We're then allocating them to three separate pots, which is essentially what the measure does. First, to the local government fund, half of the revenues, and then the remaining half, first to the severance tax fund, and then to the transportation fund. So allocation, I think, sends the message to the voters what the proposal does. Proponents would be supportive of substituting the allocation of revenues in lieu of distribution.
And I think neither distribution or allocation are specifically used in the measure. Is that correct?
They're not. It does simply say
crediting.
The word is credited, but that's a more of a technical drafting term that the public won't understand. But I do think that allocation does at least have a connotation of more of, you know, you've got the funds, then you're putting them into the various funds allocated to.
And I don't know why, but it just strikes me as being slightly better. I don't know.
So again, I guess in all of these concepts, while trying to keep the measure brief and clear, we want to suggest to the mind of the voters, and clarify the intent and objectives. So proponents would be supportive of that substitution.
Well, I'll move that change then, that we strike distribution and substitute allocation. been moved and seconded. Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
Since we're on the statement of single subject, I don't know, it seems a little odd to me to talk about tax revenues realized. It just, whether it's that the revenues collected from or generated by, but I don't know, realized seemed odd, but...
I had the exact same issue. What if you just get rid of realized and just say revenues from
I'm good with that, too. Yeah, I'm good with that. I would move that change.
Second.
So that would read, concerning the allocation of revenues from the existing state severance tax, et cetera. Comment, Mr. Call?
I'm reading through this language about existing, and I'm trying to understand, well, this concern that I've got, I guess. Would this ballot title suggest that, because the intent of the proposal is to capture all the revenue that's coming in pursuant to the severance of minerals and mineral fuels in the state, my concern a little bit by using the term existing might suggest to the voters, as well as for the intent of the proposal, that it only captures those taxes presently allocated. If there's a new tax imposed on minerals and mineral fuels in the future, would that be exempted because it wasn't in existence at the time? Does that make sense? It's a concern I have.
So what you're saying is, yeah, no, I think that's a good point, actually. If the state somehow imposes a new severance tax on minerals, that someone might come back to this title language and say, well,
that's not what we told the voters would happen, exactly. And the measure, the language of the measure is very clear that it's designed to encompass really all, with the exception of oil shale, and any successor section or successor article dealing with it, so severance tax revenues. So I am concerned that existing could impose meaning that was not intended by or reflected in the language of the measure itself. Does that make sense? So I guess we kind of go back to the question of, is it better to provide the clarity to the voters with the concept of, you know, without raising any new taxes in connection with this measure, or some alternative word that identifies its, you know, new taxes in connection. It may be better to err on the side of not providing a clarity. The board is uncomfortable with going with the concept of without raising new taxes.
I'm comfortable with whatever the proponents want on this score. I see the argument both sides.
I think that I would err from the proponent's perspective on the concern of existing Maybach's intent in there appropriately, so it would strike existing state severance taxes. But I, as to your other concern or other recent modification revenues from, is realize is fine to strike. That doesn't necessarily add anything. That's in the language of the measure, but it doesn't necessarily communicate more to the voters. In fact,
since we had adopted that by motion, I'm comfortable not following the formalities of reconsideration, but is there a motion simply then to strike the existing that we had previously inserted? I'll make that motion, I guess.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
It seems like the measure, everything regarding the distribution of the revenues is based on fiscal years rather than taxable years. And so whether on line 3, taxable should be changed to fiscal? I don't know what the tax years are for severance tax, but it seems like everything that's talked about in the measure is based on a fiscal year basis. And I'm not sure why it says taxable.
Good point.
Yeah, I'll move that change. I think that's definitely true.
Okay. Correct, taxable and insert fiscal?
Correct.
And I'll second. think so.
That's my motion.
Any objection, Mr. Call?
None.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
And in terms of Mr. Call's suggestion, now on line 5 at the very end to strike state so that the reference is only to the severance tax trust fund, I would make that motion.
I'll second that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of Mr. Call's last suggestion, I'm uncomfortable making that change to talk about an annual inflation-adjusted limit because you have two different limits, and so I don't think that that would be accurate to always say that it's the inflation-adjusted limit because it could be your non-ratcheting down type provision tied, you know, your maximum amount from the previous year. So I'm much more comfortable just leaving it to talk about an annually calculated limit.
Makes sense to me.
I have no objection to that. You know, I think from a strict technical perspective, it would never exceed whatever that inflation adjusted limit would be imposed upon. But again, I understand that from a year-to-year basis, it may not necessarily be inflation adjusted, since that's what it is.
Okay. Any further suggestions to change the staff draft? If not, Ms. Eubanks?
I move that we adopt the staff draft as it's been modified for 120.
I'll second that. And let's just take a look, one last look at it with those changes. I don't think I'm going to read the whole thing, but let's see how that does read. Sort of last call, so to speak, on changes.
Proponents have nothing further. Mr. Domenico wants to renew his motion.
Not yet.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so the motion is to adopt the staff draft as amended with the understanding the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And that completes action on number 120. The time is 5:50 p.m. Representative McNulty.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. Having sat here for the better part of the afternoon, I would like to thank Ms. Eubanks, you, Mr. Hobbs, and Mr. Domenico staff for your hard work. This is an impressive process, and you guys do a very good job, a very thorough job, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, we'll take a...